We will start out today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 351. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 351 comes to you from the from Senator Brown, and what it does is requires law enforcement agency to accept a report of a missing person at the time the report is made, prohibits the agency from refusing to accept the report, prohibits the agency from requiring the person to make the report to appear in person. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it does numerous additional other things as it relates to missing persons. There is a set of amendments to the bill, but they are still on the way coming from legislative council's office.
Okay, and I understand there's a lot of work that's gone into these amendments, and so we will take a look at them if we get them and figure out where to go from there. So we will start today with Kevin Campbell, Dave Schmierbeck, and Gino Gray. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. And I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 351, and in particular to a group of amendments that were developed through a work group process that just concluded recently, and so recently that you don't have the actual amendment language in front of you. I also know that some of the advocates for this legislation will probably be joining us. They're not here yet, but this was initiated at the request of Tom and Vicki Kelly of the Tommy Foundation. They're involved in these issues in the state of Oregon and have been for a number of years, including their work on missing children that occurred both in 2001 and 2005. They've been very involved. Also, Robert Bristow is another advocate for the needs of the families of missing persons, and so I'm sure you will hear from them soon. But in advance of that, and since they're not here, I'd like to go through briefly some of the amendments that you'll find in the amended Senate Bill 351 that we're proposing. First of all, I want to let you know who the participants in the work group were. They were Tom and Vicki Kelly, who I've already mentioned, and Robert Bristow, along with Steve Dole from Crime Victims United, Captain Edward Mowry from the Oregon State Police. He preferred that I didn't put his name as Eddie in the testimony, so please disregard that. If you could cross that out and amend that, Edward would be his preferred name now. Dave Schmierbeck, Director of OSP Forensic Services Division. Gino Gray with the State Medical Examiner's Office. They're both joining me here, of course. Sheriff Todd Anderson from Tillamook County and myself. I want to thank Tom and Vicki Kelly because they forwarded a bill that we came to them and indicated that we had a desire for some changes. The bill goes into great detail with regard to policies that law enforcement agencies would adopt if the bill were passed and would require them to do certain things. I think that they were gracious to have us sit down with them and go through the details of the bill and offer some amendment potential that both eliminated a fiscal impact that was in the bill as well as giving us some direction without requiring in statute some of the policy that was in the initial bill. I want to highlight a few of the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 351 and make a few important comments on behalf of law enforcement agencies throughout the state, or a few commitments on behalf of law enforcement agencies throughout the state, before this committee and on the record. The amendments to 351 eliminate the fiscal impact and remove mandatory policy language. There's four things I want to concentrate on very briefly. The first is that this legislation is designed to encourage the adoption of missing person policies that reflect best practices. I think in most agencies around the state that's true, but not necessarily in all agencies. So our purpose today is to commit on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police to work with our local agencies to make sure that model policies are adopted. I want to indicate that what we wanted to do in statute is we wanted to direct agencies to adopt policies that reflected the policy guidance of the Oregon Accreditation Alliance, and council wisely indicated to us that that would not be constitutional because the Oregon Accreditation Alliance, even though they accredit law enforcement agencies in the state, are a nonprofit organization and not an agency of the state, and therefore there was a constitutional problem. And so you'll notice when you do get amendments, the amendments direct policies that I'll read the language to you. Written policies regarding missing persons adopted by Oregon law enforcement agencies shall specify the procedures for investigating missing persons in order to ensure that reported missing person cases, particularly those involving minor children, are investigated as soon as possible, utilizing all available resources. And then it goes on to say these policies may include the following considerations. It goes through a list of key areas that these policies should address and ends with. It may consider the standards of the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. Let me take just a quick moment to talk about what the Oregon Accreditation Alliance does and how accreditation differs from just the adoption of a policy. By the way, there is an example of this policy, of one of these policies. It's the Kaiser Police Department policy on missing persons. It's in the back of my testimony today, and I'd encourage you to take a look at that when you have an opportunity. They're very complete policies, and they are very well vetted. When an agency is accredited in the state through the Oregon Accreditation Alliance, there are a series of core policies they have to have adopted within their jurisdiction. And these policies have to reflect best practices, but they also need to be operative within the agency. And I'm not going word from word on my testimony, so forgive me, but the policies not only have to be adopted, but officers are tested to make sure they, one, are aware of the policies, two, they understand what the policies demand, and that they're actually operative within the department themselves. And so our goal in the state of Oregon is to make sure as many of these agencies are accredited through the Oregon and Accreditation Alliance as possible. And it just so happens that the missing persons policy is one of the core policies of the Oregon and Accreditation Alliance. And the policy that exists there in the back of my testimony from Kaiser is from an accredited agency, and it's an example of what you might see in other agencies. One of the problems with putting a specific policy in statute is that things change. Technology changes. Best practices change. Federal decisions, both on a court level and in the federal congressional level, can impact policies. And also policies are not necessarily scalable in state law. So, for instance, a city of Portland may be able to handle all the policy within their own agency. A small agency might depend on other agencies in their area, whether it's a county sheriff's office or another department, in order to complete the job that they need to do as an agency. That can happen just because of a lack of resources. And so this statute will now direct agencies to consider the policies of the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. And our personal commitment as an association is to go to all of our members, all roughly 145 agencies, and to encourage them specifically to adopt these policies, to give them model policies to work from, and to give them also referral material from some of the key missing persons advocacy organizations in the state. I think it's very important that when a missing person comes forward or becomes apparent that someone is missing, that the family members of the missing person receive information on where they can get necessary support. And so we will include that in our communication with all of our agencies in the state. Let me go on to the second issue. Oh, go ahead.
Before you leave that one, it's a little unclear to me. Is it going to be required that some policy be adopted?
Yeah, no, it's not required that some policy be adopted, but what it states is that the policies that are adopted have to follow the basically the parameters that are outlined in that language at the beginning, which is, in essence, to ensure that reported missing cases, particularly those involving minor children, are investigated as soon as possible, utilizing all available resources. And then it's our job to make sure that all those agencies actually have adopted policies.
But it doesn't require that a policy be in place.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. There is an example in past legislation where we did a similar thing on the local level. And Senator Walker, I believe you were involved in it, but when House Bill 2433 was passed regarding professional stops to try to impact any potential problem with racially motivated stops, we went to all of our members and ensured that they all had adopted a professional stops policy. I envision doing the same thing with this particular measure. And so we would go out to our folks and work that.
Thank you for getting that on the record.
The second item on the list involves the impact of the original bill on forensics. And the key here is that there are available federal resources, and Dave Schmierbach can correct me if I go off down an alley here on this, but Currently, the federal government provides resources and funds a North Texas lab that analyzes mitochondrial DNA. It's available for use, but this bill needs to authorize the Oregon State Police to direct agencies to utilize it, and the language of the amendment actually does that. It does say contingent on the availability of federal funds, and that's important just because we don't want to create something in the future that ends up being an obligation of the Oregon State Police, but we obviously want them to be able to take advantage of that resource. The reason we don't mention the North Texas lab in statute is we don't want, in the event the federal government chooses either to change locations of the lab or create an opportunity that's nearer to the state, we want to be able to give the forensics division the ability to make that adjustment as quickly as possible. And so in a moment, or if you have any questions on this, I will have Dave Schmierbach answer those questions for you from a forensics lab perspective. They are, and on the record, they do have a commitment to utilizing this North Texas lab. And if he shakes his head up and down, that will be a confirmation of the commitment. along with, they've also committed to create a clear procedure for submitting DNA samples to the North Texas lab that will be added to the physical evidence manual, and they will send a letter to each law enforcement agency in the state informing them regarding the method for obtaining, using, and submitting the DNA kits. So that also, for the record, Chair Burdick, it's important for State Police Forensics Division to have that on the record as well. Two other quick items, and then I'll be done unless you have questions. It has to do with the medical examiner, and Gino Gray from the medical examiner's office is here with me today and can also answer questions if you have them regarding amendments related to the medical examiner's office. And when you do receive them, you'll find there are some amendments there. The original bill also designated in statute how the medical examiner's office would handle every case. And we also recommended that the language be changed to make sure that the medical examiner is following the best practices. And so the language that would be inserted into the bill says the medical examiner shall make reasonable attempts to promptly identify human remains following the current forensic autopsy performance standards of the National Association of Medical Examiners. One of the nice things we found out in the work group is that in the state of Oregon, of course, we have a state medical examiner's office, unlike some other states where this model legislation has been forwarded, where they handle coroner's responsibilities on a county-by-county basis. And so, in fact, the sheriff of a county could end up being the coroner. Obviously, we have great confidence in our medical examiner's office, and in conversations it became clear that we have a lot to be proud of in terms of both of our medical examiner's office and our forensics division. Those are well-respected, not just in the state, but around the nation. And as a result, attaching this to the best practices in the National Association of Medical Examiners is a prudent way to go on that. There are additional impacts potentially on medical examiners in this that we addressed in the amendments, and Gino Gray can mention those if he would like when we're done. The last one simply makes a name change in the Missing Children's Clearinghouse. In the original bill, it changed the name of the clearinghouse to the Missing Persons Clearinghouse, and in conversations with the Missing Children Clearinghouse folks, Judy Hayes over there that runs that program, we came to the agreement that the recommendation in the amendments would be to change the name to the Missing Children Persons Clearinghouse so that the word children continues to be prominent within the name of the organization. This would involve a change in how they handle things, and they would be, in fact, a clearinghouse for additional information, but they felt like it was important to continue to identify specifically children in that name. And so, while it's a minor change, it's one that I wanted to note for the record.
But are they extending their scope from children to older people?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I believe they are, and I believe that according to conversations with the clearinghouse, they believe they can do that within current resources. But I will, again, ask if either Ed Mowry or Judy Hayes would like to clarify that for the record later, they can do that.
Okay. All right.
Obviously, we're at a little disadvantage without the specific language of the statute in front of you, and I'm sure that you'll want to take a closer look at those amendments when you receive them. But I wanted to highlight those four main areas, and then if you have any questions or if you'd like, either with your permission.
I appreciate it. This is kind of putting the cart before the horse. We were hoping the amendments would be ready by now, and I always like to give deference to taking on bills early that people have come from out of town to testify on, specifically my former constituent, Dede Coons, sitting right there. So what I'd like to suggest is, as we proceed, the amendments may yet show up, but if we get to a point where we do it on another day, to maybe have those of you who are available just come back, certainly you, and be a resource if the actual amendments are here.
Great.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the section of the medical examiner, I'm just reading the language you have here, and I understand they're not legislative council draft, but is the intent so that to make it so that you can change rules as time goes on long if those standards change?
Senator Beyer in the committee, I'm Eugene Graham, the forensic administrator with the State Medical Examiner's Office. And that is correct, is to make sure that we don't have in law standards that may change later on. And the accreditation body, the National Association of Medical Examiners, who comes up with performance standards, when those standards change, we will adhere to the current acceptable practice standards of the profession.
Well, okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just looking at the words that you put here as a quote. I'm assuming that's what you put down as the legislative council, and you said the following the current forensic autopsy performances. If you add the word the in front of current, does that lock it into the ones that are in place when the bill passes? And should it just say following current?
And just the current standards that are approved by the National Association of Medical Examiners Board.
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, I may agree with you on that. I mean, maybe we defer to council, but yeah, we obviously don't want to tie us to the standards that currently exist today. We want to be able to, they want to be able to change them as they change. So you're
that's a good point, and I think we might take a close look at that when it shows up. Council, did you have any?
Madam Chair, I just heard something, a delegation issue to the national standards of where?
The National Association of Medical Examiners, which is a accreditation body in the United States and has a board of directors, has a forensic oversight committee, and they are the ones that come up with the national standards. They're the ones that come up with accreditation for medical examiner's facilities.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that raises constitutional questions about the state cannot delegate to a private entity the ability to create standards. That will probably be an issue raised by legislative council.
Well, you mentioned that early in your testimony.
Yeah, Chair Burdick and Council Taylor, if that is also a private entity, you're right, we would need to change the language just to avoid that problem, which we could do.
But you do that by making it advisory.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
Would consult with them, but not be bound by them. Okay. Because what was the, you mentioned the same issue in connection with another group. What was the other group?
Right. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, the other group is the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. And it is, there's a similar, CALEA is another national entity that accredits law enforcement agencies. All of these entities that accredit are not, none of them are government agencies, as I understand it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I guess to the point on any of these, if you, when you're talking about tying it to current standards, not the current standards, because if you put the in front of it, it locks you in, I think, at the point in time when the bill passes versus ongoing standards.
We're very grammatically fussy in Senate
Judiciary.
That's
good. That's good.
And it pays off. Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Do either of the two of you want to add to this?
Yes, if I could, for members of the committee, Madam Chair.
Can you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Eugene Gray with the Oregon State Medical Examiner's Office.
Yeah.
Regarding the change in the current wording on the bill that indicates that the Medical Examiner's Office will notify the Department of State Police within 24 hours of any unidentified person, the current ORS 146 says within 30 days. For us, that is leaving it at that standard is a more realistic standard for us. Just to give you a little bit of an idea, we have 30,000 deaths roughly in Oregon per year. Of unidentifieds that we truly have unidentified, we deal with about 2 to 5 per year. Currently in 2006, we had 2 unidentified. So most of the cases that we are involved in, we identify them with our forensic evaluation. Most of those evaluations cannot take place within that 24-hour period. We have many entities that are involved, forensic anthropologists, forensic odontologists, forensic scientists. What we would be doing with that 24-hour period is we would stop our wheel of investigation to make a notification so other entities can make a notification on a potential unidentified and cause a snowball effect for us to come back a short time later and retract that information. So it would cause a lot of time and resources to be expended before we've truly been able to do an acceptable forensic evaluation for that identification. So again, what we would recommend is to leave it at the 30 days.
And does the amendment leave it at 30 days?
Yes. Chair Burdick, yes, it does.
And in practice, do you always take 30 days, or is it sometimes more quick?
No, it really depends on the circumstances of the case in itself. If we have exhausted all leads in a particular case and it's only been a week, certainly we would initiate that entry into the NCIC system, National Crime Information Center system, through the Department of State Police. But typically what the law has done is if we haven't had, expending all of our resources, if we haven't had somebody identified in that 30-day period, we will initiate that.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Dee Dee Coons.
Chair Burdick, with your permission, I'll stay up here.
You again?
I promise not to say anything.
Well, I request it. My name is Dee Dee Coons. I'm a member of Crime Victims United. My husband and I were founders. My husband's name was Bob Coons. We were founders of Crime Victims United 23, a little over, years ago. I'm also a member of Parents of Murdered Children since their second meeting in Portland in their very beginning. And that's something like 24, 25 years ago, I believe. Both of those organizations highly endorse this measure. We have a great need. I'm not here to speak of the issues or the merits in the measure. I'm here to speak as the experienced parent of a daughter that was listed as missing for 20 years. My daughter was murdered in San Francisco. My husband and I became certain that she was a homicide victim very early, actually almost immediately. But her body was not found, and there was not a prosecution. So we investigated ourselves along with hiring some help. And we investigated, we continued to do that for 2 years, almost solid, and into the third year. Some families can go into denial, or some families are not able to do that. But both Bob and I were, Bob died 3 years ago this month. Mom and I were responsible kind of people that felt that it was our responsibility to take that information that we learned when we were investigating Valerie's murder, which took us all over the state of California and farther, actually, and share that. We had come to know people in Oregon who had also had similar experiences of ours. And of course, over the years, almost everyone who has a missing daughter at some stage of the investigation, the law enforcement or victims' representatives contact us to talk about that. We denied doing that for a while, because in our case it was about as bad as a case can be, and it wasn't a very uplifting thing for people who had first had their child missing. But the toll on our society is tremendous of missing people who are never identified or through all of those years that their bodies are missing. There is an emptiness left in the family, and there's a great deal of pain. I lost my daughter. I also lost a giant piece of my future. I lost my future grandchildren that she probably would have had. Every family gathering, and I have three wonderful sons, every family gathering, there's a missing piece. That our Valerie was not there. There was some relief when finally her body was found. It was purely by chance, the whole thing. 11 years after her body had been placed in a river in Washington, a mile this side of the Canadian border, in a remote county and area of Washington. She was placed in the Kettle River in Ferry County. Ferry County only had, at that time, four sheriff in, as their law enforcement, I think one DA. Some hunters found her skull on a floodplain. She had been placed in the river with her feet in a tub of cement, quick dry. And they're still there, as are her legs. Pretty grim information. Most people don't want to hear it. Neither did I. They did an excellent excavation, finding all of her body parts except for her legs. And the Spokane office did the forensic work on her remains, what there, you know, was left. Animals had affected it. They figured that she had been washed up that first flood after she was placed in the river. And the forensics medical examiner who did her body was pretty new, and she made some rather drastic mistakes. And she had made our tall, slim, strawberry blonde, quite beautiful daughter. Somehow she came up with it. She was Asian and a Native American, probably because there was a reservation in that county. And all the people who were looking for Valerie, the Canadians and us and others, of course, were misled by that. They did a drawing that made this very ugly person. And big nose. Her nose was like mine, pretty small. And for 9 years, those sheriffs in Ferry County sent out over the nation dental records or dental impressions. And finally, 9 years later, a forensics medical examiner in Sacramento, California had recently gone through and saw that there was a missing person who had incisors, teeth had a hook on them. And when that ninth year, Valerie's x-ray or her the imprint of her teeth came through, he remembered those hooks and went back through what he had recently gone through, and that's the way she was identified. And there was a young man in Washington named Lewis Cam, who writes for the CIA, is an investigative writer for the Seattle PI. And Lewis did a series of articles. I think there were 8 over a 9-day period. And he had done tremendous research on missing people and had found that there were thousands and thousands, even in the state of Washington, that had bodies that had been recovered and never identified. He used, that was fairly shortly, I think within the next year or so, after Valerie's identification, that he used her case as one of the cases that he featured. And he had a great deal of information. I had the wonderful opportunity of meeting the gentleman who is the director of the National Victims Office at a conference, and talked with him about missing person and the study that Lewis had done. And so when I got home, I called Lewis and asked him to send all of his information to the victim's office. And he did. He's called me since and said that there's been some very wonderful results of having people pay attention and had used some of his information. So I urge you, please, to support this. It is easy to deny the pain and anguish of others for some people if they have not experienced that pain.
So you think it would be helpful to really strongly encourage law enforcement agencies to just have policies in place, because it doesn't sound like you're dealing with that.
Yes. The thing that Lewis found, for the most part, was that the people who were not identified and then were at some great later time was that law enforcement had not made a record, that they had made an assumption that the person had run away or something. And believe me, there's a great deal of difference between somebody with a suitcase and a smile on their face leaving at the airport, and there is someone who is obvious that there's foul play. And, of course, that would be different legislation, but all of it has to work together before that we will have diminished to the best of our society's ability the situation of families never knowing, never having that body, what remains of it to bury. My Valerie is buried down beside her dad in outside of Albany, between Albany and Corvallis. I grew up in Corvallis, Bob grew up in Albany. She's buried beside her dad, and there's a memorial bench that we did for Valerie. And there was a certain amount of comfort and for me to go down and be able to put flowers on their grave. And I still talk to Bob. And we need that.
Okay. Thank you for coming, Dee Dee. Really appreciate you coming. Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
I just want to thank Ms. Coons. I know you've worked.
I'm sorry, I can't hear. I'm kind of hard hearing.
Okay. I just want to thank you. I know you've been a strong advocate over the years, and I know what happened to your daughter, Valerie, is a mother's worst nightmare. And thank you for being able to continue to share your experiences with others to help us make our laws better.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you, Dee Dee. Okay. Senator Byrd, do you want to say something?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just looking at, Section 8 of the bill, and the medical examiner is gone now. It's part dealing with 24 hours versus 30 days. And I just, and perhaps council could clarify, they'll have that. As I reread that, does that really say 24 hours after the person receives the body, or is it 24 hours after the person can't identify who the body is?
Well, that's been replaced in the amendment.
Well, I know, but they want to leave it at 30 days, but as I read this again, is this giving them, it's Section 8 of the bill, page 5, would this be giving them 30 days after they can't identify the body to make the report, or 30 days after they receive the body? Because the way I'm reading this, and I understand the intent is to let them exhaust every attempt they can to identify the body before they have to make a report. And so, Mr. Kraft, you could clarify.
Madam Chairman of the Committee, I think we're talking about Section 8 between lines 30 and 34. We're talking about the current statute, ORS 146.515, and it reads, if a medical examiner is unable to determine the identity of human remains, comma, the medical examiner shall, comma, no later than currently 30 days after such remains are brought to the medical examiner's attention, notify and provide the superintendent of the state police or the superintendent's designee all information in the medical examiner's records concerning the remains. 30 days would be changed to 24 hours, and it would be starting to run after the time that the medic is unable to determine identify the human remains. When they make that decision, they can't identify it, that would start the clock running.
Well, and that was my second read, Madam Chair, and I think the intent was to not tie the hands and make them go to report after 24 hours after they received a body. But the way I read this, under current law, they have 30 days after they can't identify a body to make the report. And I don't think that was really the intent that was spoken to by the medical examiner. I think they want to have every opportunity to identify the body and then give them some reasonable time to make the report.
I think that's a good point. Let's see what Mr. Campbell has to say.
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, I'll have to check on that. I do know that one of the issues they run into, and the reason they take the time they do in some cases, is that once they report the information, they put it out there, a lack of specificity about the identifying information creates a huge response that's vague. The lack of specificity creates this huge response from any number of agencies trying to identify missing persons. And so what they indicated to me and to the work group as we were talking about this is they wanted to make sure they got this done as quickly as possible. So that was always the goal. But in cases where they're trying to get additional information to fill out the profile of the person they believe they're looking at, the more information, the better. The less resources that are spent kind of following up kind of false leads. And so they try to do it as quickly as possible, but I know they want the time to do enough of a job to create that specificity. But I will see if I can get to the medical examiner's office for the purpose of getting you a specific answer to your question based on your reading of the language.
Okay. In the meantime, we have the amendments in front of us, and I have also been notified that some of the people who wanted to come today thought the hearing was another day. So we'll probably end up hearing some more about this. Yes, Andrea, I see you on the list. So we will conclude our hearing today with Andrea Meyer, and then we will not take action on this bill today.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. While I was not on the work group, I did speak to Mr. Campbell about some unintended consequences that we were concerned about, and those have been addressed in the proposed amendments. But there's one area that hasn't been addressed, and I've spoken to Mr. Schmierbach and Mr. Campbell about this, and there's a willingness and an ability to do that, which is the opportunity if a person who is missing is found alive or the next of kin if they're not, to be able to get back the DNA that's gone to the Oregon State Police and the database. You know, these databases generally are criminal DNA databases, and we want to make sure that folks who get in these who are not required to be in them but are for reasons either they or their kin are quick, give the information and they're entered, that they likewise be able to be removed from it. Mr. Schmierbach said that they already have that ability and do that in another situation. They just need statutory authority. And as I said, Mr. Campbell and representatives from Senator Brown's office expressed a willingness, so we'd like to help on those amendments just to give that authority. We'd like to have it as work out something so that the individuals, either the next of kin or the person who was reported missing who was found alive, could get some notice of that. We don't necessarily need to make the notice shall, because that makes everyone nervous. But if you have the right to get your DNA back, but you're never told you do, it's sort of a meaningless right. So we'd want to try to tie it to the person or persons who are doing the investigation who might have the file to make reasonable effort to give the information to the person or the next of kin, and then they can invoke that if they so desire.
Okay, well, maybe you could work with counsel on that. That seems like a reasonable thing to work on.
I just have one question. Doesn't law enforcement have to keep the DNA for a period of time until all the appeals are exhausted?
Senator Burdick, Senator Walker, but this is a person who's not a criminal. And if there's a criminal action going on, for instance, I think we can make it so that when it's releasable or at a time period when it's appropriate, I would think that the next of kin or anyone involved would not want to get that back until there's resolution. If the victim's DNA is relevant to that, but happy to accommodate that.
If the victim's DNA is relevant, for example, if they're a victim of a crime, then you definitely wouldn't want to remove that from the database.
Right. Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, arguably not, although I think, you know, it's a question of whether the next of kin or the victim, if they're still alive, decision to make.
Well, if the victim's still alive, that's one thing, but if the victim is not alive and it's a victim of a crime, you'd want to account for that.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I think so, but I think any family would want, if the state police said we need to keep this in the database for purposes of criminal investigation. I can't imagine a family member invoking the requirement saying give it back, but I think they should have that opportunity to do that.
Well, Madam Chair, it just seems to me it could be written into these model guidelines that we're drafting up here that you tell family members that this DNA can be returned to you upon request.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, it's our preference that at least at some point and some language be inserted in statute. While I've talked to Mr. Schmierbach, and he's like, absolutely fine with it, and I would believe that currently they would do that, don't want to leave it to agencies to be making that decision. Policies do change. I think it's appropriate for the legislature to make a statement that, you know, if a person wants, they don't become part of a criminal database unless they've been convicted of a crime. That's the threshold that's required by statute for you to obtain those DNA currently in the criminal database is a statutory authority you've given to law enforcement to obtain those. So here, likewise, we want to make it clear as part of Oregon's policy about moving forward with DNA that there's statutory authority for the person to retrieve it if they so desire. I can't imagine this is going to be invoked or very infrequently, but we just think it's important as we start creating these databases that we start delineating between the persons who've been convicted of crimes and those who've not.
Well, and also any other DNA that's found on the victim or around the victim could be kept in the database.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I don't know if the Oregon State Police enter into the database the DNA that they find on a crime, but that's part of a crime scene, and you've got and the normal course of crime and the rules and the authority under that would come into play. And this doesn't seek to interfere with that in any way whatsoever.
Okay, well, why don't you work with Mr. Schmierbach and Mr. Campbell and see if you can come up with something.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anybody else who wants to testify on this today? We'll have an abbreviated hearing when we work this bill. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 351 and open a work session on Senate Bill 328. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 328. comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission through the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. And what it does is allows the juvenile panel of the Psychiatric Security Review Board to direct the Department of Human Services to place a youth in the panel's jurisdictions in a specific type of facility or to direct specific care. The panel determines the current placement is inappropriate as it creates substantial danger to the youth. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this basically relates to not kids that are mentally ill but are developmentally disabled and present a danger to others. You have a set of amendments in front of you. They are the dash five amendments, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I was in a work group meeting this morning on these amendments, and they are consensus amendments coming in from the Law Commission. Wendy Johnson is here to address some of the policy issues in the bill and any amendments, and I can walk through the amendments for you, or Wendy can do it, however you would like to do
okay,
it.
Okay, Wendy, why don't you come on up, and Mara, did you want to come up as well? You were involved in it? Okay. Wendy, you want anybody up here with you?
I think I'm okay. Good, unless you have questions that I can't answer.
Okay, welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. This bill did have a hearing some weeks ago, but not everyone got to speak. Actually, Julie McFarland spoke and gave her support of the bill from the defense perspective. This is the first time that Law Commission staff has testified on this bill, and so I do have three handouts for you.
Okay, thank you.
Members of the committee, you actually should remember the Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board from last session. Senate Bill 232 passed through Judiciary Committee and then on to Ways and Means and then eventually through the House and was passed into law, creating a disposition for juveniles who are successful with a mental disease or defect defense. They have a all juveniles have a constitutional right to raise an insanity defense, otherwise known as a mental disease or defect defense. There was nothing in Oregon juvenile code to speak to how to raise the defense, what the process was or what disposition was, and so the Law Commission had a work group, and then the Commission itself recommended a bill last session that passed. In the last few weeks of session, one group of juveniles was taken out of the bill in terms of disposition, and that group of juveniles were those who have the mental defect of mental retardation. That was taken out at the request of the Department of Human Services for fiscal reasons and perhaps other policy reasons. The department was asked to address that group of juveniles this session, those juveniles who have the defect of mental retardation. The Law Commission also had been watching it to make sure that hole was plugged, and so the Law Commission is recommending Senate Bill 328 this session to deal with the minor issue of those kids who were taken out last session, those with a mental retardation who are successful with the defense. What the bill does is provide that those juveniles can raise the defense, and their disposition would also be to a psychiatric security reward. It's a juvenile panel. And so that's what the bill does. The amendments fix a couple of mistakes that were made in the original bill, changing deleting the word young person, or the focus is on whether there's a whether mental retardation was the defense that was successful. If they also are a danger to others, that's what we care about, to come under the disposition of the board, not the danger to themselves. That's the standard that's proper. And we also deleted a sentence regarding security. The bill talks about security a little bit, but that's up to the department to choose placement, and so the sentence regarding a locked or other type of secure hospital wasn't needed because it was duplicative of the board having the authority to direct the type of care. And then you will see a new Section 6 in the amendment that clarifies the board's rulemaking authority and also requires the board to consult with the Department of Human Services on before it issues rules and before it adopts rules. Though that amendment was requested by the department, because the amendment was late in the process, it hasn't been approved by the Law Commission. So the Law Commission is neutral on the rulemaking request. But to my understanding, there's no objection to that provision to add in the rulemaking provision or to delete the sentence regarding the locked facility.
Okay, and there's also no fiscal. So I assume there's a fiscal coming along. Mary Claire is in the back there. Maybe Mary Claire, could you come up here and give us a little insight onto
Chair Burdick, regarding the fiscal, because the board was approved last session, the board starts in effect during this session, the fiscal was already calculated into the governor's recommended budget. The only thing that we're adding in is that mental retarded juveniles who are successful with the defense can now have their disposition with the board. And because there was the budget note that those children also needed to be addressed this session, I think that it's covered under the governor's recommended.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, Mary Claire Buckley, Executive Director of the Psychiatric Review Board. That is correct. We just had our budget hearing a week ago, and the funding for this, for the entire panel, is included in the governor's recommended budget.
Oh, okay. So we don't need a Ways and Means referral then, if it's in the budget. Is that right, Council?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding. Okay. And there's no prior referral, so.
Unless the co-chair has whacked it out of there.
Well, we're just going to be optimistic. We're just a bunch of optimists here. Okay, thank you. Is there any questions from the committee?
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to say, and it's not, we can't do that in this bill, but I really am offended by this description of mental defect, of mental retardation. I just think there has to be a more humane way of saying that instead of defect. And I'm just throwing that out there. Maybe some of you can think about that. Anybody want to respond?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, that's just been the name of the defense since 1983, guilty except for insanity. Also, conjures up some concerns as well, as you can imagine, but for the insanity defense has always indicated mental disease or defect, so
it just seems a little bit insensitive, and mm-hmm. I just am uncomfortable with it, but that's the way it is. So,
well, some Scrivener's bill in the future when we come up with a better way of doing this. Senator Cruz, did you have a question?
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Council?
No questions.
Lindsay Johnson, looking at Section 3 of the bill, and subsection 3 of Section 6, we kind of go over the scope as it relates to what they'll be consulting with the DHS on.
Of the Dash 5 amendments?
That's correct.
Chair Burdick, Council Taylor, Sub 3 requires the board to consult with the Department of Human Services before it issues rules and before it issues rules, both before comment and before it adopts rules, and it's regarding any rules that the board would choose to adopt. The board is given authority under sub 1 to clear authority. They already have authority in Chapter 161, which is the board, which is the adult board generally is referred to. They already have rulemaking authority, but this makes it specific that the juvenile panel has rulemaking authority. And then if the board does decide to enact rules, all rules shall be consulted beforehand with the Department of Human Services.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I think just for clarification, the reason that is because the board has oversight over the safety, because these juveniles have committed a crime if they were an adult. We call it an adjudication. But the Department of Human Services provides the treatment services, whether it be mental health services, or if the juvenile is developmentally disabled, it'd be DD services. And so that there is a relationship between the two, but it's the board who writes the rules.
Okay. Well, I would like to send this. We're approaching a deadline here, and I'd like to send this along the way, but not if you have any doubts about the Law Commission not having looked at the amendment.
Chair Burdick, as I said, the Law Commission has not weighed in on this new provision regarding rulemaking, but that's not a substantive, doesn't change the defense or anything, just changes the process for how our two executive branch agencies work together. And so I don't suspect that anyone would have any concerns on that front from the Law Commission. We were concerned about making the insanity defense for juveniles truly a defense, because there was no statute, there was no disposition. Now defense attorneys, DAs, and judges have a process that assures public safety but also provides treatment.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. I think Senator Beyer wouldn't have left if he'd had serious problems with this. That's pure speculation.
Yes, it is.
So we are in work session, and if the two of you like this, we can move it, and if either one of you don't, then we can't.
I'm okay.
Senator Cruz, could we have a motion on the Dash 5 amendment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd move the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 328.
Senator Cruz has moved the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 328. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 328 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 328 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Do you think Senator Brown would like to carry this bill? Senator Brown will carry this bill, and if she reneges, we will find someone else to do it. Thank you. Okay, we have one big bill up now, Senator Walker. Senator Brown, is there anything you'd like to say as your pre-carrying statement on 328?
Say it on the floor.
Okay. Senate Bill, opened a work session on Senate Bill 379. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 379 comes to you from Senator Walker. And what the bill does is require school employees to complete training each year on the prevention and identification of child abuse and on the obligation of school employees to report child abuse. Requires school to make this training available to school parents, requires the Department of Human Services or law enforcement agency conducting an investigation generated by a report of child abuse to notify the person filing the report of the outcome of the investigation. Measure applies to 2007-2008 school year, takes effect upon passage. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have in front of you the Dash 2 amendments to the bill, and if I remember correctly, Senator Walker, you worked with DHS on these amendments.
I did, counsel, and
I'm ready to go through them if you'd like me to do so.
Okay, yeah, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Walker, on page 1 of the bill, deletes requires and inserts provides to, so it says an education provider shall provide to school employees training each year. And then it does the same thing on line 29. And then going over to page 4, last part of the bill, it deletes section 7 and inserts this language. When the department completes an investigation under this section, the department shall make diligent efforts to notify the person who made the report of child abuse to the department about the outcome of the investigation, comma, if contact information for the person was provided to the department.
Difference on that?
So, Chairman of the Committee, for one thing, it says it clarifies that the department has to have the contact information. So if for some reason the person calls up and makes a complaint, the agency still has to go forward, but if the person making the complaint doesn't leave their phone number or address or something like that, then that would relieve them of the burden of doing so.
And you're comfortable with that, Senator Walker?
I am, and we took out law enforcement agency in here because law enforcement just can't possibly respond to every single person who's made a complaint. We had a work group on the 5th of February to discuss that issue, among other things, and so we removed them from that. And then there was a little bit of an issue over diligent, the word diligent, and I apologized to the department in an email, and I will make that apology officially for the record. When I got the Dash 1 amendment back, I didn't look at it that carefully and thought it had reflected what the department had sent me, and the department was not happy with the Dash 1, and I was angry and said, how can you be not happy with the Dash 1 when it was your amendment? Well, it turned out not to be exact, and it didn't come back from council the way I'd requested it. So it is now fixed, and I do apologize on the record to the department. Sometimes they get it wrong, but sometimes they get it right, and this time it was me that got it wrong. So I appreciate everyone's efforts, the School Boards Association, Oregon School Employees Association. We tried to get this bill last session, and it got hung up, and I'm hopeful we can move it this time.
Second time's a charm, Senator Walker.
Protect our children.
Noted. And is there any distress from the audience? I see no distress in the audience. Senator Cruz.
Okay, just clarification, because I mean it now says that educational provider shall provide to school employees training each school year on prevention and identification,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't does it is there anyone statute that defines what that is, or so they could get something similar to what we get as legislators? I mean, is that, Senator Walker, is that kind of what you're envisioning as to the requirement and some signs to look for?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, I wanted to leave it up to the district to provide their own training, whatever they see fit to do. The Department of Human Services has an excellent training, which we all were privy to. And as you know, I just have this real problem that we have all these mandatory reporters and we don't provide any training to them. So this is an effort to make sure that gets done. Many of the school districts are doing it already, and Jim Green from the School Boards Association is in the back of the room nodding his head. And I have to commend the Salem-Keizer School District, because after they had an incredibly egregious case of child sex abuse in their school, their district put a lot of emphasis in it. They took money, a huge amount of money, and invested it in a very elaborate program. You don't have to have an elaborate program, but they did that, and I was very pleased that they did that.
Manager, could I ask Mr. Green a question, if he doesn't mind?
While he's coming up, Council has some.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, child abuse is defined, in fact, it's referenced, particular statute is referenced in Section 2. It's defined in RS 419B005.
Well, I know it's child abuse is defined, but the training was a component. I guess my question, obviously this is not overly burdensome per se to large school districts, but I'm looking at the really small school districts and do they have, how are they going to have the resources, the people, the knowledgeable people, that sort of thing?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, there are several ways that they'll go about that.
Can you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. Thank you, Madam Chair. There are several ways that they'll go through that, Senator Cruz. There's an organization out there called the Oregon School Personnel Association that will help provide training on this area. And I do have a little bit of knowledge in this area. My brother's a detective with Clackamas County who does child abuse investigations. He does trainings for school districts in Clackamas County at no charge to those school districts. Also, our policy department will work with them on getting folks in. And also, the education service districts are going to take a lead in this, helping those small rural school districts so that they're not just, and I've talked about Troy before. I'll use them as an example.
I was going to ask you specifically about Troy.
There you would have the Wallowa County ESD bring those school districts together to provide the training for the staff. And I do want to thank Senator Walker for bringing this. We do have school employees. All of our school employees are mandatory reporters. And the problem has been we don't provide adequate training for them on it. And this bill will mandate that, which is something you've heard me scream up and down about mandates over my 15 years representing the School Boards Association. But this is one that's good for kids. And this is one that we will work to implement, the Oregon School Personnel Association will work to implement, and we'll make sure that the training occurs. There are a variety of entities out there. I think Senator Walker said DHS has an excellent training program. They've also produced a video that's available across the state, and County Sheriff's Office and local law enforcement work together to provide this training. I think it's something that it's high time we put into statute to ensure that these kids are protected.
Thank you, Mr. Green, for putting it on the record. I just, as our small rural schools are on the verge of extinction, which some of them are, and it's an issue we're going to have to get real in dealing with at some point. I just don't want to be putting more burdens on them unnecessarily. Not disputing the importance of this, but thank you for putting that on the record.
Yes, thank you for that. Any other discussion?
I did want to thank Jim, Mr. Green's brother. He did testify last session and came in and talked about their program. I appreciated that. And Ms. Tricia Smith was also quite helpful because there's more than just teachers in the school. There's all kinds of classified employees. And we expect all of these folks to be fine, upstanding citizens, and my gosh, most of them are. But, like in every profession, there's some bad apples, and these are our children we're talking about. And this was the companion piece to last bill, last legislative session, to allow people to access the disciplinary records upon conviction of an employee so we could find out what was going wrong and why this happened. So I think this is a very critical piece to that legislation we passed.
Thank you for your diligence, Senator Walker. You showed diligence on this bill. That's a new word of this session.
Diligent efforts.
Okay, we are in work session. We have a dash two amendment and a chorus of Kumbaya going in the background. So
okay.
It's to you, Senator Walker.
I'll make the motion for the dash two amendments be adopted to Senate Bill 379.
Senator Walker has moved the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 379. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker.
I move Senate Bill 379 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 379 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who should we get to carry this?
I think I've already written that down.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam
Walker
Chair.
Will carry. Thank you. Okay. Last bill. Save the best to last here. Open a work session on Senate Bill 733. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 733 comes here at the request of the State Court Facilities Task Force, and this bill does have a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee. Creates the Court Facilities Planning Commission consisting of 14 members appointed as follows: two by the governor, one by the one Senate Democrat, one Senate Republican by the Senate President, one House Republican, one House Democrat by the Speaker of the House, two by the Chief Justice, four by the Association of Oregon Counties, two by the Oregon State Bar. Requires a commission study and make recommendations on the minimum standards for suitable and sufficient state court facilities to be built or renovated with state financial assistance, develops criteria for prioritizing courthouse improvement projects. You have the dash one amendments in front of you. You may remember what Senator Beyer brought up the last time this bill was up before us on the 22nd of March. Going over to page 2, line 20, subsection 4, the Court Facilities Commission shall make recommendations, and the word that we would substitute is may make recommendations. And Senator Beyer was concerned that they would be required to make recommendations even if they didn't want to make recommendations.
Correct. I thought that was one of his better catches on this. So.
A person with too much time on their hands.
Guy actually reads the bills. It's amazing.
Too bad he's not here to get this appreciation.
Get the credit for that.
Yeah. Okay, I would like to move this bill on to the Ways and Means Committee if you all are comfortable with that. I see nods. Mm-hmm. So, Senator Walker, could we have a motion on the dash one amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 733.
Senator Walker has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 733. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And now, Senator Walker, I would like a motion to send it to Ways and Means mm-hmm. by prior referral.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 733 be moved to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior referral with a due pass recommendation.
Very well done. Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 733 to the Ways and Means Committee by prior referral with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Oh, yes.
Any discussion?
Well, only that I just hope we understand the serious decay and disrepair our court facilities are in and how we need to modernize them, and we've just got to do it. We can't keep ignoring the issue like we did the state hospital. So I'm very hopeful. This is one step to get us there, but we've got to start paying attention.
Well, we definitely do, and this will allow an orderly process, a comprehensive process, and I just hope we can get it done before an earthquake hits Multnomah County.
That's right.
And other counties as well. Okay, so ordered. Any other business before the committee? We are adjourned.